Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
I'm Sheila Shoigev, and welcome to Ready to Be Real Conversations, the podcast series where I chat to people of all walks of life. Some names you'll recognise, others you might not, but my hope is that these conversations will at times inspire, challenge, educate, comfort, or simply entertain you. This week, I speak to Professor Roseanne Kenny about ageing.
People who perceive themselves to be younger than their chronological age, independent of anything else, independent of whatever disorders they had, be it arthritis, heart, it doesn't matter. Independent of all of that, you actually function at a more youthful age.
We all age, but why do some of us live longer than others? Why do we live twice as long today as our ancestors did 200 years ago? And what does the latest science teach us that'll help us not only to live longer lives, but also to live fitter, healthier and happier lives deep into our later years? Professor Kenny is the founding principal investigator of Ireland's largest adult population study on the experience of ageing in Ireland, the Irish Longitudinal Study on Ageing, known as TILDA, now in its 12th year of data collection. And I started our conversation by asking her the obvious question, how do we live longer, healthier lives?
Although we're living longer, the actual time we spend with some level of, I suppose, medical terms, we call it disability. That means arthritis or heart disease or even dementia. That duration hasn't changed. We still spend 1/5 of our lifespan with some level of disability. So our aim is to pull together all of the evidence base that's out there, both from the TILDA study, the Irish study, and our sister studies worldwide, and any other sources, to see what's the evidence for how we as individuals or as a society can reduce the period of time we spend in ill health or in disability, so that we do have a longer, healthier lifespan.
And that's what it's all about.
That's what it's about, yeah.
And you live and breathe your own work. You've spent 35 years
researching.
And this is not just, this is my research and this is my life. You've very much incorporated what you've learned into your own life.
I have, as I've learned.
Yeah.
And I'm as vulnerable as anybody else to troughs and peaks, of course. I kind of think that a reasonable rule for any of us to live by is an 80-20. If we get it really right 80% of the time, then there'll be 20% of the time when we slip. And that's okay. Perfection is almost impossible for us as a human species. And it's particularly impossible the longer we try, you know, throughout the lifespan. And that's one of the other things that we talk about in the book. It's, you know, the earlier you start, the better. Like, I hope 20-year-olds are listening to this, because what I'm saying relates to them. And it doesn't just relate to their preparation for when they're 60, 70, 80, 90. It relates to them now, to better health now. But of course, it also prepares them for the future. So the earlier the better. But you know, the great thing is it's never too late.
Yeah.
And that's true for introducing diet, and it's true for introducing physical interactions, physical activity, physical exercise, and it's true for social connections or even having a purpose or all of the other things we know affect us biologically.
Let's talk about that, because as you said, this is a podcast for anyone of any age. We're all going to get something out of this. But you've carried out, again, lots of studies on the 20-year-olds, the 60-year-olds, the 80-year-olds in terms of implementing change and what that can add to your life expectancy, which is quite fascinating.
Yeah, it is. I mean, that I think that's the most exciting piece about the work, is that aspects of our lives that we intuitively know are kind of good for us, like having friendships, you know, night out with friends, you feel good the next day. But so how can that be from a biological perspective? What's going on in your cells that make you feel good? And that's what the discovery has been in the last couple of decades that I think is the most exciting. Things like friendship actually impact on what we call the hallmarks of aging within a cell, the different pathways and networks in a cell that are the function of that cell are positively influenced by being happy, having a friendly discussion with somebody, by laughing,
yes,
by having laughter,
yeah,
by a positive attitude. There are loads of studies out there to show that if you take a positive approach to life and you believe in yourself and you have a positive attitude towards aging, you know, you feel younger than your chronological age, you actually, independent of all other confounders, are biologically younger. I love that.
Yeah,
I think that's remarkable. And the fact that we've actually been able to track that back from a physiological perspective is fascinating.
In our 20s, we feel invincible. You know, we can have the burgers and chips, we can have the late nights, and we feel like we can go on forever. But what we do in our 20s impacts our later years and all the rest. So if you make changes in your 20s, what are you doing in terms of adding those all important years?
So to kind of drill down into some hard science on this, there's a very recent paper in the context of diet, and from the University of Bergen just a few weeks ago. What they did was they took meta-analysis, so all of the studies that were relevant with respect to good diet, okay? And probably the best diet is the Mediterranean diet. There's no doubt about that. That's been shown time and time again. So say take a good Mediterranean diet, vegetables, lentils, beans, nuts, not a lot of red meat, very little red meat, and low in sugar, low in salt, and low in processed foods.
And the odd glass of wine.
The odd glass of wine is not excluded at all from this diet. Plenty of water. So if you take that diet and call that the optimum diet, and then you take our Western diet, which is what we eat, the burgers you're talking about, and the processed foods. I mean, we don't infrequently not nip into a supermarket and get something that's ready-made. But actually, if you read what's behind what looks like mashed potatoes and minced meat, you will see that there are a whole load of additives and other things, lots of salt, even sugar. So if we take a Western diet has been the what we have now, the optimum being the Mediterranean, and then they did what I'm talking about, the 80-20, a kind of feasibility diet. What if you got it right 80% of the time? And then they modelled, using all of the available evidence, what that would do to lifespan at age 20. And they showed that if you could keep to the optimum diet, you nearly added 12 years to your life expectancy at 20. That's remarkable.
It is, yeah.
And you even added 9.9 or 10 years if you did the feasibility diet, okay, the odd blip. Then they looked at 40 and they found that you still extended it by something like 5 and 6. At 60, 3 and 4, and even at aged 80, if you'd eaten a Western diet and you introduced the optimum diet, you almost added at age 80 another 2 years to your lifespan.
So it's never too late.
That's my point. It's never too late. And we know this from exercise, from physical activity. No matter what age you introduce exercise regimes that are new to your body, it has a positive benefit.
I'm also really fascinated by what you said there about your biological age versus your chronological age. And I'm not sure where what you would think of somebody like me. So I am nearly 43. I've always been very open about my age. I don't fear it. I kind of embrace it. I sometimes and often don't feel my age, though, but I have no problem in saying what it is.
But what age do you feel?
Well, I mean, as a mother now of two kids and I have a baby girl of 4 months, I feel 103. But
No, really.
No,
what
honestly,
age do you feel?
I probably feel in my 30s.
Yeah, that's it. So that's your biological age, probably.
Okay.
So that is hugely important.
Mm-hmm.
Even in the Tilda study, with a girl called Deirdre Robertson, who was doing her PhD with us at that time, that's exactly what we looked at. You know, the questions around your perceptions of how you're aging.
Yeah.
And then we measure so many different factors that we were able to adjust for all of those and just look at that one thing, how you perceive yourself aging and your physical aging in subsequent years, because we've been following people for 12 years, and your mental aging, your cognitive aging, memory, concentration, planning ability, etc. People who perceive themselves to be younger than their chronological age, independent of anything else, independent of whatever disorders they had, be it arthritis, heart, it doesn't matter. Independent of all of that, you actually function at a more youthful age. And it starts early. In the Dunedin study, which have been following their participants since they were born, 1,000 babies born in the 1 year, they're now in their late 40s. When they were age 38, they were able to measure what I'm talking about, biological age, by looking at epigenetic clocks, which are kind of the little biological clock in all of our cells that tell us how old that cell actually is, okay? And they took people aged, all of them were the same age, 38, but biologically, their ages ranged from 28 to almost 50, even though they were all 38.
Incredible.
And then, of course, they were able to say, well, why? These kids are all 38 only. What is it that's influencing their biology that's accelerating the aging process? And it pretty much was adverse childhood experiences, poverty in the home, poor education, starting to smoke early, excessive drinking, taking drugs, depression, etc. So they weren't surprising things, but they really emphasize how important the early years are at embedding our life course experience.
Now, another thing I wanted to talk to you about was, I suppose, the part that genetics play in all of this, because my own grandmother is 102 and thankfully hale and hearty. But, and people say, oh, you know that bodes well for you. But actually, it only makes up for 20%.
Maybe 30, but probably 20.
Which is in its own way is reassuring, because we have a lot that we can control.
Absolutely. I completely chime with that. Isn't it great that there's 70 to 80% of our aging process we can control? And so for people who've got a really bad history, that gives them great solace.
Yes.
So, yes, there is that much that we can control. But there's an onus on us, therefore, to control it. It doesn't entirely fall true in that if you make it to 80, generally speaking, the impact of genes is a little bit stronger than in younger years. But up until the age of 80, it's 20, maybe 30%.
Right. Let's talk about the things we can do.
Yeah.
You've already mentioned the importance of what we put into our bodies and movement. But there's also a window in which we eat that, if we implement this, can have huge benefits to our lives.
This has actually become really popular recently amongst all age groups, and that's calorie restriction. And I go back to one fundamental animal experiment that I really like in mice, where two groups of mice, same age, were given same amount of food. One was allowed to eat away over a 24-hour period. The other was confined to an 8-hour period. And the mice that were confined to the 8-hour period didn't get obese, whereas the others did. And they were pretty much matched in all other ways. That's just a nice example of how much it matters.
This sounds groundbreaking to me. You know, because we hear all the time that, okay, you know, it doesn't matter when you eat, it's about the calories that you eat. But you're basically saying that's not the case.
I think there's pretty good evidence that, well, certainly, you see, we're very much governed by our circadian clock. So that tells us when to wake up and light in the morning. It kind of governs our day, including our eating patterns and when we go to bed. So it chiming with that clock is rhythm.
Yes.
And chiming with that clock are fixed periods when the body expects to get input. If you think how we have evolved as hunter-gatherers. So we're used to having periods during our evolution when we're hungry, when we don't have food. And then when we get food, we take in as much as we can. Nowadays, we don't have the former challenge. So if we want to take in as much as we can do it 24/7. That's not how we've evolved. So it's much better that we restrict and we restrict our timing now. And we kind of tease our body with the way it's evolved with periods of food restriction. That's what it's used to in an evolutionary sense. Now, there's loads of different ones, and I don't actually recommend any single one because it depends on the individual. Some people, I run a blackout clinic in my clinical time, and I see a lot of people who absolutely cannot fast. They become weak if they fast. So for those, definitely the 18-hour fast or 16-hour fast is no good, you know, where they don't have breakfast. They need a breakfast in the morning and a lunch. But there's no reason why that core people can't still remain within an eight-hour window when eating. No reason at all.
So eat early in the day and wrap up early.
And there's different clocks. So there's a clock where you might just start at 1 o'clock and you eat within a 6 or 8 hour window after 1 o'clock.
And this is what you do.
I like this one.
Yeah,
I like that
works
one.
For you.
I do have a coffee.
You're allowed to have coffee.
Then there's maybe one day a week you fast. Maybe 2 out of 7 days you fast. You just take 600 or 800 calories in, something like that. There's a whole load of different ones. And I've mentioned them all in the book, but individuals need to pick what they want. The point is to convert our energy source to ketones from using glucose and sugar all of the time and storing it as glycogen. And that increases the amount of white fat in the body, and white fat's not good. So the whole point is, you know that ketotic feeling where you feel like you need to eat a bit? You know that sometimes as a scent off the breath? That's ketotic. That's what we mean by ketotic. So you need to kind of feel that level of, I need something to eat. And then you know it's being effective.
Okay. So you just become more in tune with your own body and learn which kind of rhythm will work for you.
Which of those diets? They're not really diets. It's just calorie restriction. It's just sensible eating and calorie restriction. If you can couple that with the optimum diet, that's really important.
You'll be flying it. You'll be living well into your hundreds. Okay. You mentioned it as well before, the importance of connection, being with people, laughter. And I couldn't help but think, wow, what we've all been through in the past 2 years with COVID. And yes, we had the Zoom parties. Maybe we didn't all have that, but it was difficult to connect because we were told to stay at home and isolate. And I would imagine that had, I'm not trying to bring the mood of the conversation down because I think this is hugely uplifting, but it has been a difficult time.
Yeah, I think we're only realizing the impact of COVID now. At least I am, when I reflect back on it. It was massive. We did do a wave of collection during COVID, actually. And we had just done one just before COVID. And we were able to compare an awful lot of factors. And just two things. Loneliness increased threefold, three times more common during COVID than it was before. And people over the age of 50, this was. And loneliness is terribly bad for us. We're gregarious animals. We need people. We need engagement. And just a lot of the policies, through no fault of anybody, and people were trying to do their best, but a whole lot of the initiatives, the policies, the attitudes were very isolationist and very prone to making people lonely. I remember being told by friends or even patients at the time how they'd seen somebody who was living on their own and how they couldn't believe how much they had failed over the last number of months, say, for example, during COVID, when they were on their own. And that actually is a graphic illustration of how detrimental social isolation and loneliness is to a human. And I noticed it myself with patients and with people. They involuted. They became frail during COVID. And that was simply because lack of engagement. Then for some, it became really difficult to engage again. So on a positive note, what do we need to know? We know how bad this is for us as human beings. All of us know someone, I think, that we can reach out to. So that's number one, just to make a bit of an extra effort. Lots of people are finding it difficult to get back into any sort of rhythm of engagement. And they've lost friends as well. Don't forget that. And family.
Yeah.
Some under dreadful circumstances when they weren't able to visit them in hospital. And then they got in for a period of time before they died. I mean, I think that will live with people for a very long time. It's not something they'll get over very easily. So I suppose as far as possible, let's reach out at an individual level. But wouldn't it be great as a society if we started to embrace how important this issue is? Mm-hmm. We're actually becoming much more isolationist in everything. Yeah. Technology is taking over so much that we're not encouraged to face-to-face anymore.
Yeah.
We're not encouraged to be in gatherings. And people are ashamed. You know, mental illness, thankfully, has come to the fore. It's much more acceptable to talk about it now, to recognize it. To say you're lonely, to say you don't have friends is really, I don't think, an easy thing for someone to do.
No.
It's not as socially acceptable, unfortunately. So at a societal level, it would be great if we were to embrace that and say, okay, as an Irish society, we're going to do something about that. Now, I don't know what. I don't have any magic solution. Mm. Talking cafes, you know, places like that which encourage people to get together, ensuring that everybody in a community has a menu of options or choices of things that are happening that they can engage with, something like that. We don't do a lot of that. To do that more and in a more proactive way would be a wonderful thing.
Yeah. I'm imagining that a lot of people are probably like me, thinking of people they know that perhaps are a bit lonely. It might be you yourself, because even if we are living with people, you can still experience loneliness. And as you said, it's a very difficult thing to admit, because it's probably you're making yourself so utterly vulnerable mm-hmm. by saying that. But I think the realization that a lot of people experience loneliness, that it's far more common than we realize.
Mm.
But also, not just the importance of living longer, but as you said, the key to all of this is living happier, healthier lives. And you mentioned it as well, the impact of dementia, of just going downhill, I suppose, and the importance of engagement, of that sense of community, sense of tribe, you know, being together, talking, laughing, games, that kind of thing. Can we talk about what you would encourage people to do in terms of their cognitive health and well-being?
Yeah. First of all, I love this little piece of science where a colleague in University of Chicago did some work from a longitudinal study where he looked at the brains of some of the participants in the study after they'd passed away, of course. Hmm. And he took brains that had exactly the same neuropathology. So when he looked at them under the microscope, they had the same amount of, we all get a bit of dementia pathology, believe it or not, as we get older, everybody does. But it doesn't manifest as dementia in everybody. So he took that dementia pathology and in, say, 10, 12 brains, six of them had no evidence of dementia in life. And six of them had clearly been clinically demented in life.
Okay.
There was no difference in the density of pathology in the brains. What was different was the six that hadn't manifested had a whole lot of social engagement and activity and friendship.
Wow.
They lived in a household. They were constantly being stimulated compared to the others.
Mm.
So the most important thing for brain function as we get older is variety and stimulation,
yeah.
whatever it comes from. Variety and stimulation. and not to feel loneliness, you know.
So. And that's not sitting in front of the telly.
No, it's whatever. You, I mean, sometimes, well, okay, laughter is really good. And sometimes we get laughter from sitting in front of a television,
okay.
Frankly,
yeah, you know. Yeah, yeah.
So, but it's the more television and technology are very new to us. Mm. I mean, you know, we haven't evolved with that. We've evolved with social engagement.
Yeah.
We've evolved with facial cues. We've evolved with body language. Mm. You know, that's what we understand. And that's how we best communicate is face to face with somebody where possible. So, but variety is the other thing. So variety, it doesn't matter what variety. Yes, crosswords work. Yes, dancing works. Yes, bridge works. Yes, sports work. You know, and the more you can do that involves doing it with other people, the better.
Okay.
But to keep the mind and body active, it's the keeping the body active is also good for the brain because there's a good cross linkage across the blood-brain barrier of beneficial proteins. So mind active, brain active, both the same thing.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, Dave.
Yeah, Randy.
Since we founded Bombas, we've always said our socks, underwear, and T-shirts are super soft. Any new ideas?
Maybe sublimely soft.
Or disgustingly cozy.
Wait, what?
I got it. Bombas. Absurdly comfortable essentials for yourself.
And for those facing homelessness.
Because one purchased equals one donated.
Wow, did we just write an ad?
Yes.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase.
Cool fact, a crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Also, you can get health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
And the studies you carried out on the blue zones in the world, those, is it five areas in the world where people have proven to live longest?
Yeah.
That sense of tribe and community is something that is linking all of them.
It's huge. Now, if you again get a picture in your mind of what most of those zones are like, I mean, think of Icaria in Greece or Sardinia. You know, they're by the sea, they're up on a height, but the houses are all built up, and the houses are nearly one on top of the other, and many generations living in one house. So if you go down one of those little narrow roads, you know, there's loads of people going down those little narrow roads. You can see into everybody's kitchen, so you're not isolated when you go into your own home. You're part of a community. I've often thought, actually, that when I pass different communities in Ireland, even in Dublin, you know, that the so-called D4, D6 areas with the houses set back from the road and on their own, etc., are very isolated looking compared to much smaller communities where there's an awful lot of activity on the road. Houses are small, terraced together, but there's a whole lot of activity all the time happening around you. And I don't know, I think in terms of our geopolitics, we need to think about the importance of community when we're developing areas. There's a lot of loneliness amongst young mothers, for example, who aren't working, who are in housing estates. The housing estate empties of working people all day. They can very often be on their own with just young kids. So loneliness is pervasive. And I'm sorry to keep going on about loneliness, but it's part of the variety, and it's part of laughter, and it's part of having a purpose in life. It's key to share with others. There's a great experiment actually showing how important sharing is. It was done in University of California, and the psychology students, two groups of students, they were both told, okay, you're going to do a debate. And before and after the debate, they measured different neurohumoral factors. That's blood pressure, heart rate, skin stimulation, factors that we know involve the nervous system that's involved in thinking process, the autonomic nervous system, and hormones that are involved in stress. So they did them at baseline, said, you guys are going to do a debate. And then they did it after the debate, but they divided the class into two halves. The first half was allowed to share what they were going to say in the debate and share their ideas with each other. The second class had to work alone. Okay. And then they gave their debate, and then they repeated all of those stress markers, the nerve and the hormone stress markers. The group who had shared had far lower stress markers after debating than the group who had managed it on their own. So a problem shared is a problem halved. So remember that. You know, it is good to share it, even with someone that you don't expect to get an awful lot of feedback from. The very fact that you've voiced it and you've shared it helps you.
Yeah. We hear a lot about people being an extroverted personality type or an introverted personality type, but essentially when it comes down to it, as humans, we don't do well on our own.
No, because we're gregarious animals, as I say. You know, lovely stories that I cite some of them in the book about baboons. There was a notorious baboon called Sylvia in Botswana, and she lorded it over all of the others. And she had one daughter, and you know, she'd swipe at them, and she was a nasty piece of work,
right?
But happy in her nastiness.
Okay.
Then her daughter was killed.
Okay.
And her behaviors changed to helping to groom other baboons and their children and helping to look after them. And it just emphasizes how much at all levels we need other people. And she realized that she had what she needed in her daughter. But when her daughter was no longer there, she had to find alternatives because of her innate nature.
Yes, yes. Fascinating. Obviously, we're talking about all the things that we can do. And sleep is one of those that thankfully, there's a lot of focus on, especially in recent years, and the importance of it. Something I'm probably not getting a huge amount of personally myself, but I know it is a phase right now. But it's really important, isn't it, to get the proper quality sleep.
Yeah, sleep is important. Now, I'm hesitant even to say that because, you know, people will be listening to this saying, that's all very well, but I've tried everything, etc. Because, you know, many people don't sleep well. Many people do have issues with sleeping. What can we do? I suppose, first of all, to be aware. Napping isn't a bad thing. It might work for some people. So don't be afraid to nap. Know your napping time. Try not to nap after 3 o'clock if possible, because it'll interfere with your longer sleep that night. Sleeping tablets, well, maybe occasionally it's okay to kind of get you a good night's sleep. It doesn't really get you a good night's sleep, though, because it's not a natural night's sleep. There are foods which are not great for sleep. They interfere with sleep.
Caffeine
and tyramine in them. So anything spicy, some of the blue cheeses, Chianti wines, Italian Chianti wines, particularly high in tyramine, etc. List of foods that I've cited which interfere with sleep that people mightn't be aware of. And then there are foods which are good for sleep. Lovely study on men, where men were given salmon 3 nights a week to eat, and their sleeping patterns were significantly better. So omega oils work, and oily fish work, and fish in general probably work.
Yeah.
And there are lots of other things that have tryptophan or apigenin in them, which are helpful. Chamomile tea has apigenin, and it does help.
And are these supplements you could pick up if you needed to?
Yeah, you can pick them up as supplements. Supplements are interesting. There's a huge market in supplements in the USA. The actual evidence for supplements, apart from vitamin D and omega oils and maybe C, is very poor. There isn't really evidence for vitamin E, for example, and yet how many people take vitamin E supplements? And it's probably because there are so many different isoforms or types of vitamin E. Maybe the supplements just don't get the one that in the different dietary forms does definitely have a positive benefit. So the message there is, insofar as possible, to take all of those so-called supplements that we know about from foods, from natural foods, if possible.
Now, you mentioned wine there, certain Chianti wines, maybe not so great for your sleep. But you also mentioned earlier that the odd glass of wine is okay.
Yeah, I think if you have a rule whereby you never have a drink unless you're having it with somebody else,
Okay, like that, yeah. Mm. So again, that's the engagement.
That's the connection. Yeah. I think that's a good thing. Now, people will again be listening to say, oh, I have my glass of whiskey at night and it does me fine. Thank you very much. That's okay. Horses for courses. Actually, alcohol does interfere with sleep patterns. And it's, yes, you get off maybe to sleep more easily, but it interferes with the balance between rapid eye movement and non-rapid eye movement sleep. And we need that synchrony and balance.
Okay, let's talk about movement and the importance of incorporating more exercise as we age rather than less.
Yes, I have a little rule, if possible, to do more after the age of 50 each year on year, rather than less. Now, it may be that you would walk a little bit longer or whatever exercise you find works for you. It is important also because we lose muscle mass after the age of 40, nearly 1% per year. It's important to do resistance exercises or something to build muscle. So it isn't sufficient to do aerobic exercise. And yoga is great because yoga couples meditation with exercise. So it's good. And again, meditation and mindfulness itself is very good.
Yes. So don't be afraid to pick up the dumbbells with maybe obviously some help because you can do yourself an injury.
I've just put my, just prolapsed one of my disc doing it excessively. So yes, you can do yourself an injury with care.
Yeah, with care. And as you said, practices like yoga are great because it's not just about looking at the physical body, but it's also, you know, taking into account what your state of mind is.
Yeah.
And all of those things are so intertwined and again, are so important.
Pilates is wonderful. And practice your own balance. Our balance goes off as we get older. Three things control our balance. Our eyes, a thing called proprioception, which is sensors in our joints and in the bottom of our feet, and our vestibular system in the ears, which connect with the brain. And as we get older, we become more reliant on our visual input to balance, and we both proprioception and the vestibular system declines. But we have to keep exercising the vestibular system. So stand on one leg for 30 seconds, each leg, with your eyes open, and then try and stand with your eyes closed for 10 seconds. Say when you're washing your teeth or you're at the sink doing dishes. Just do it couple of times a day to train your balance. Really important. It reduces falls, and falls are one of the big thing as we get older that we're much more prone to. I mean, our data has shown, it's quite unbelievable how the prevalence of falls increases after the age of 45, around the menopause actually, for women, and after about 50 with men. You know, our fall rates increase such that it's 1 to 2 falls a year becomes much more common, whereas prior to that it was uncommon.
Okay. And in terms of being active, ideally, you know, get up, move. A lot of us are on laptops, on computers all day long, particularly, you know, people working from home during COVID times. You got to get up and you got to move.
So this is good for brain blood flow.
Okay.
To stand up every 45 minutes, because otherwise the flow to the brain isn't as good, and you'll find your concentration and memory and stuff isn't as good if you've sat for a 4-hour period. This applies to every age. So 45 minutes sitting, stand up, even if you just stand up, but preferably stand up, walk around a bit and sit down again, you'll function better.
Mm. Okay, let's talk about sex, because it's something that also is massively important in terms of feeling good in your body. And obviously, again, if you feel good in your body, you're probably going to extend your life expectancy.
My kids hate when I, well, they used to hate, they've become used to it now, they're more mature. When I start talking about this at the dinner table, because it fascinated me. I have a great friend in Chicago who made this her life's work, Stacey Landa. And she was the first to kind of really, she's a gynecologist, but got interested in gynecology and aging. And she was the first to really kind of introduce this whole topic and how important it was. And how much it meant to quality of life and how prevalent it was. I mean, you know, I think younger people feel, oh, sex, that doesn't happen after 50. I can't even bear to think of my parents,
et
cetera. But of course it does. It's very prevalent. 60% of couples in Ireland are sexually active once a week, once every 2 weeks from our study.
Well, I certainly would hope that in my older years that I will still be, you know, enjoying it. I don't want to
studies from the States and Germany into your 80s and 90s, very active. And actually, it's not sure which the direction of causality is in my next statement, but people who are sexually active have much better attitudes towards aging and feel themselves to be younger than their chronological age. But it's not clear whether that's because they're sexually active or, you know, because they're sexually active. Doesn't matter what the direction of causality is. Anyway, it's possible. B, it becomes more difficult because, of course, of biological changes, you know, mucosae become drier, etc. Impotence becomes slightly more common in men, but that's okay. All of those factors can be treated or addressed.
Yeah.
Patients will say sometimes, oh, I'm mortified, I can't talk to my GP about that. Your GP is trained to listen. Yeah. To that. I mean, you know, the amount of research that's gone into this area is limitless almost. So go speak to somebody about it. And if they don't have an answer for you, then ask them to explore it or to get you to see somebody who does have an answer.
Yes.
This is a terribly important part of our lives. And how dreadful that one wouldn't pursue it. And feel the consequences of not pursuing it, actually, when it can be easily dealt with.
It's amazing that as the years roll on, and I think it's all relative. So somebody in their 20s will see me as much older. Somebody in their 60s would see me as much younger. But definitely as the years roll on and I am softer around the edges than I've ever been, I'm much more confident and comfortable in my skin now than I was as a far slimmer, fitter 20-something. And I am loving this new kind of freedom that comes with, I suppose, maturing, realizing that being alive, being well, is such a privilege.
Yeah.
And I see it more and more with people, how they just let their inhibitions go as years roll on. And it's almost like I'd love to go back in time and have that chat with my younger self. Yeah.
So, what can I say? Women particularly actually mature more and they don't care. There's some great literature around this, that they're not that they don't care in general, but they're not as hung up on things that gnawed at them, which were futile.
Yes.
The other thing I think we lack that's awfully important in this culture is intergenerational friends. I've been lucky to have, I have friends who are older than me and friends who are much younger than I am, mostly through my sons. I've come to know some of their friends and I value them. And it's, my God, they bring so much to my life and I think I do to theirs. Mm. But we don't do that much in Ireland. You know, we're very much inclined to stick with our peer group. In many ways, our peer group, both socioeconomically and demographically. I think we need to embrace friendship across generations because there'll be a huge lot of valuable transition if we do that, of wisdom and shared experiences.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned as well the importance of our attitudes. So this really comes back to how we feel about ourselves.
Yeah.
What we tell ourselves.
Yes.
And, you know, how we feel in our bodies, because for a lot of people, and something I have to personally battle against, that inner critic, that negative voice in my head that looks in the mirror and sees what she doesn't like rather than what I actually have.
First of all, make a list of all the good things about yourself. Mm-hmm. Everyone should do that every so often. That's really, really important, and value that. And that's what I find about meditation. I do a little bit of meditation. I don't do nearly enough. But I, you know, don't, when you're meditating, somebody who was interviewing me said, oh, every time I try to meditate, all sorts of thoughts come into my head. That doesn't matter.
Yeah.
Look at that as exercise for your brain. Mm-hmm. They'll go. As they come in, you recognize them, get rid of them.
And that's what it is. It's really good for your brain. You're just bringing yourself back.
And it helps. And do, yeah, you know, 2 to 5 minutes twice a day. We can afford that. So just take it a step at a time and do things gently. We're inclined to be very hard on ourselves. And share. If you share an experience with someone, like get a friend and say, okay, how about the two of us doing this for this 2 months? Makes it so much easier.
And so everything you've spoken about is looking at the physical, but also looking at mentally what we can do and how we can improve our cognitive function, but also on an emotional level, on a human level, that connection piece is vital, which I'm so glad that you have, you know, explored so extensively in the book as well, because I think for a lot of people, they they don't think of that, the importance of that aspect of it.
Yes.
Of, you know, connecting with friends, making sure that you have that night out, because, you know, we've been so starved of it over the past 2 years. So maybe we all need a bit of a nudge in that direction. I think, as you said, we've become a little bit rusty, and some of us are a little bit fearful probably of getting back out there into society again after being told for so long to stay at home. And we know that anxiety levels have increased during this time. So we do need to go gently and kind of honour where we're at, but also maybe slightly push ourselves out of our comfort zone, that it will be beneficial if we do that.
In terms of reaching out to other people, I would say. Make that, you know, something that takes, acknowledge it'll take extra effort and put that extra effort into it.
Because we all know that feeling when you come away from being with your friends, from having a good laugh, you feel so much better. You feel energized.
Yeah. Oh, there's great research on laughter. Actually, there's fabulous research. Do you know, even animals laugh, even rats laugh. Mother rats tickle baby rats. I mean, it's amazing.
Yeah.
Laughter is, again, we've evolved with laughter. It's a form of communication, of bonding. It's a form of bonding. And if you think about laughter, there are lots of different types of laugh. I mean, the sort of laugh you'll have with your boss is very different to the heartfelt laugh you'll have with mates, Having a good laugh is really good at a hormonal level. It releases lots of hormones that are good for brain function, but also physical function and the heart.
And being silly, being childlike, allowing that to be a part, isn't it?
Yeah.
Never lose your childlike innocence, as they say. Professor Roseanne Kenny, thank you so much for your time. I know it's precious, so I really appreciate you being here today. Your book really is becoming a global phenomenon. It's been translated into many different languages. It's available worldwide. It is Age Proof, the new science of living a longer and healthier life. It's a fascinating read, and I'm so grateful for you being here.
You've given me a lovely interview. I enjoyed it. Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of Ready to Be Real. If you're a fan of the podcast, please show your support by leaving a rating or a little comment on Apple. You can also click follow and rate on Spotify, or you can share it with pals in real life or on social media. You've been listening to Ready to Be Real Conversations.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to Quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. Quince.com/style.